Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this August the 6th on the West Coast, now August the 7th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. What a mouthful that is. We want to welcome all those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, and also let you know that we are heard pretty much on every continent around the world now. So we are coming directly to you from the Republic of the United States of America. And that is the lowercase U in United, just for specificity. Well, for the past couple of weeks on Friday nights, we've been talking with our regular Friday night guest about this concept of free energy and what it really is, what it really means, and the concept of producing power and what the goal is in the end, which is work or productivity. And we're going to talk about that some more tonight, and we're going to talk about some outside-the-box types of systems that could be used to produce power, to produce work, and make our lives much simpler and less polluted. Tonight's guest is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher. He is my co-host every Friday night, and he is our resident science advisor, none other than scientist, inventor, extraordinaire, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Don, thank you. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
Not too bad. It's been a rough week. Got an awful lot on my plate this week. But I survived it, so I guess I'm okay.
All right. We had agreed that we were going to keep this topic going for another, at least another session on the show this week. We've been talking about different types of technologies, and you've highlighted certain scientists and certain scientific inventions, and the orchestrated cover-up of these inventions and what advantages they could bring not only to our country but the whole world. And you discussed the suppression of those inventions and even the liquidation of the inventors themselves. And although it's a dark topic, it's a very real topic. And it deserves more discussion. Of course, we want to present possibilities, solutions, and we know that there are a lot of people out there already of like mind who are intent on changing this paradigm that we have of absolute control, metering everything that literally occurs on this planet. So I wanted to give you the opportunity. I think last week at the end of our show, we were discussing quartz crystals and the variety of uses that they provide in terms of using devices that are constructed to do specific types of work. And they seem to be very accurate and very efficient in how we're using them, and I think we're not even really scratching the surface as to what the application of crystals of all sorts may forebode for mankind in the future. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a very broad topic, as you know, and the thing that sticks out most in my mind, to be real honest with you, when we talk about that subject, is the idea of water being a crystal, which is a little bit hard to understand because I think most people assume that crystals have to be something hard or glass-like. But actually, they're defined by the geometric arrangement of their constituent molecules and how they stack together, you know, in the various arrangements that nature provides for grouping and how much volume they occupy. And I'm not an expert in the field at all, but water definitely falls into the category of being a crystal. And the reason why it's interesting is because it's really being investigated very heavily now in the Orient, especially China and Japan. It's been found, for instance, that water can be programmed with intent and with emotion and even with the concept of health. And the interesting thing about that is it opens up new vistas on the possible meaning of prayer and healing and things of that sort, because it's a known fact, for instance, that blessing food before you eat it really does affect the food. There's no question about that. That's been thoroughly investigated, and it's been shown that it even can affect the level of nutrition that's delivered to the body. And my theory on that is that since the food we eat is probably at least 80% water in most cases, sometimes more than that, that what's really happening, of course, is that the crystalline structure of the water, which is locked into the various foods that we eat, is being affected by the intent of those who are providing the blessing. And it does change the resonance of the food and therefore the effect that it has on the body that consumes it. And, of course, this is only the beginning. I mean, my gosh, there's more to say about water and what it's all about, perhaps, than almost any other subject. But I'm just fascinated that it can be defined as a crystal. And actually, Don, that brings me right back to your abilities. You have incredible gifts of being able to ascertain information directly from your mind and from the intuition. What are your feelings on the possibility that water itself, as a crystal, can be utilized in ways that we don't even dream of right now?
Well, I have a lot to say in that. First, let me interject something, if I may, and then I'll come right back to your question. I thought of this last week when we were talking, and you had brought forth this concept that that water is a crystal. You know, we have this term that's been out there for a number of years with the advent of microcircuitry. First of all, when we got into integrated circuits, which use IC chips, which are nothing but integrated circuit chips, they're smaller, compact electronic devices that allow one to assemble a whole variety of possibilities in terms of control and measurement of various types of data, and the readouts for those, which were electronic devices that were put somewhere in the circuit, depending on what their function was, were referred to as liquid crystal displays. And they lit up usually according to the design and the purpose. They would either be red, sometimes they would be blue, yellow, or green. Usually they were any of the primary colors. And that may not be exactly the same thing you're saying, but there would be a display. Let's say the liquid crystal display would be a counting device, and so it would have the capacity to count up to a certain number, and as it's moving through its cycles, which sometimes are very rapid, you could see the numbers changing, but you really couldn't count them. Your mind, I think, and your eye is capable of catching the movement and actually seeing it, but you couldn't do an accurate count until it stopped or paused at a point where you could actually read it, because they can move so fast depending on where they are in the circuit, as I said a moment ago. So I wanted to mention that, and maybe you might want to touch on that in a little bit. Now, as far as water stores information, and it does it in a variety of ways. It both stores it and it allows it to be transmitted through it as a medium. So water can store light. It can store sound. And although sound has a tendency to travel through water, which is usually in some kind of a container, and I would say on a metaphysical level, water has the capacity to store beneficial energy, and that can be a higher frequency of sunlight or a higher frequency of one's spiritual essence. One can actually put their own power into a glass of water merely by holding it with their fingertips and toward the sunlight, so the sunlight strikes it. You actually charge it both with sunlight and the psychic energy from the individual. Now, you don't have to believe that. I'll use the word belief there. You don't have to believe that that's actually occurring, but it's measurable, and it has an impact on things that that the water is applied to. Say, for instance, if you charge the glass of water the way I'm describing, and then use that to feed your houseplants, you'd be amazed at how well they do. Or you could actually use that to clear up an ailment that a person has. It's very effective in that way. So I see, and I have always seen the possibility of that. In fact, I think that could be taken even further and introduced into technology like computers, for example. So, you know, to answer your question, it's got a lot of possibility.
Well, it's interesting you ended with that particular note, because, as you probably realize, the human brain is a very gelatinous mass, and although it consists of a lot of complex proteins, it's also mostly water, and it's being used as a kind of a computer, and it's funny because only a little while ago I was speaking with a friend of mine who's quite an authority on the mapping of the human brain, and when I first met this guy, he was not real open-minded with respect to the possibility of the brain being plugged into the universe in any way, shape, or form. He sort of had the more materialistic way of looking at it, that even though it's a really marvelous piece of equipment and something that you could never duplicate artificially, it was nonetheless a kind of a chemical computer, and aside from the fact that it's a marvel, it didn't warrant any special attention outside of what it's already being given. And he's the kind of guy that you don't want to argue with, because you don't get anywhere really. But the neat thing about it was, all by himself, a few weeks ago, he came to the conclusion that his own research has brought him to the belief that the, I forget what the area of the brain was that he was talking about, but there's two apparently two regions, one on each hemisphere, which is extremely sensitive to electrostatics and various types of, I hate to say radio waves, but let's call it some type of electromagnetic wave activity. And he suddenly came to the realization on his own that the brain may, in fact, be an open-ended device, which is coupled into the universe in some way. And then I was telling him about, well, I don't find anything strange about that. The various ancient religions have always believed that, and as a matter of fact, there's a term called the Akashic Record, which fulfills that function, and I don't see any reason why that couldn't be what you're coming against in your own investigations, because I don't think there's room in the brain for all of the various psychic phenomenon and unbelievable memories that pre-exist the people who experience them and all kinds of other phenomenon. It really looks as if the brain could never hold all that information, even though it can process it and manipulate it. It almost suggests that it's coming from an outside source. And I was really amazed at the fact that he came to this conclusion all by himself. And so it's a very interesting way of looking at it because, you know, that automatically brings you into so many areas of investigation that have been the life's work of many people. You have Wilhelm Reich and his understanding of the fact that the life force, or the hormone, as he called it, was a spiritual thing which affected the mind, and then the mind affected the body, and the body, you know, was the ultimate expression of the character of the person who occupies it. And then you have Schoberger, who studied water in great detail, and his concept, among others, was that water holds a very special type of magnetic charge, which can affect health, which has everything to do with the growth of plants and forests, and also it can become an energy source under the right conditions. And even Tesla's work, believe it or not, enters into this area to some extent because he was dealing with machines that allowed him to couple directly into the unseen forces that are around us, and that allowed him to sustain operational gains in his equipment, which far exceed what can be explained by the confines of linear physics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's time that all avenues of investigation realize that the mechanistic approach to life is not only limited, it's unreal.
Yes,
yes.
You know,
this
past Tuesday, Jim, I did a show, a monologue on illusion, and I talked about the different aspects of what makes a human being, and I spoke about the spiritual as being the highest essence or the highest frequency, and I spoke about the physical body being a vehicle and the mind basically being a tool that's used. And so, you know, saying the mind and the brain are really two different things because the brain has the capacity as to how it's constructed to both receive and transmit information and of different frequencies. They can be of light frequencies, which is our connection to our sight, or it can be sound frequencies, which is our connection to our ear or ears. And it's it goes on because we can sense things through the hair of our body or through our auras, our energy field. So there's a lot of what makes up the physical reality of the human being, whether one sees it or not, doesn't exclude those realities from it. And when one says, well, we're only using 3% of our brains, or, you know, somebody gratuitously threw out 10% last week. I heard that from somebody. I don't recall who. And I thought, oh, so somewhere in this madness and this chaos going on in the world, people's brains are all of a sudden gaining 7 or 8% more efficiency and are still 90% lost. Now, and it leads you to think, what if we started using all of our brain? How would this information transmit and receive? In other words, how would I be able to communicate? Well, most likely, I would develop telepathy. Or anyone who was experiencing a shift in their brain's ability to process information and receive it or transmit it. Transmit it to whom? Well, to the universe. When you transmit it to the universe, you're in a way transmitting it to everyone else and everything else. And that's why our thoughts are things. That's why our thoughts affect things. And we affect each other, and whether it's conscious or unconscious, that process is always going on. So it wouldn't surprise me that someone that was seriously looking at what how the brain responds to certain types of stimuli or certain types of information, the more frequencies it can handle, the more gifted it's going to be, the more things it will be able to do. So if you're talking about mental analysis and computations, it'll be able to do much more. One will have a better memory. One will have a better sense about the choices that they make. One will work more efficiently and rest more efficiently, and as a result, be healthier. So there are a lot of positives, and, you know, this is outside of psychology and psychiatry. I don't even want to attempt to go there because I think it's all screwed up the way it's being run, to tell you the truth. The people that are treating mental patients often are the ones that should reverse the roles and sit in the chair of the patient and let the patient work on them. And I hear that from people in that field. So, and reading many of the things that we've read over the years, I think you'd probably agree with me. To misidentify the true nature of the spirit or the mind or the body is as much a mistake as it is to tell somebody that they're not thinking correctly. What does that mean? Does that mean that they're not following someone else's orders? You know, because that's not a natural thing to do. That's not how the universe was created. It has its own order, and we would do ourselves much good to learn what that is and to practice that, to put that to use. Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to take a spin on the comment that you made about the percentage of the brain that's being used. You know, it's really interesting. Our present day concept of concentration is essentially focusing on one task or one channel. Not necessarily one channel of information, but one conglomerate of incoming data. Like, for instance, watching a TV show, looking at a computer screen. You may be using several senses when you do that, but your entire concentration is on one subject. And the interesting thing about that is that when they take scans of the brain of people who are involved in those kind of activities, they in fact are using a very small portion of the brain to accomplish that. and I don't remember the exact number, but it's substantially small. So let's say like 5%, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
However, you take the same individual, or at least another individual, and put him in the wilderness somewhere, where his very existence is totally dependent upon processing multiple sources of data simultaneously. And he's no longer concentrating in the same way as we define concentration, but there's a change in awareness. And that change in awareness is demonstrated by the fact that his brain scan under those conditions demonstrates an enormous utilization of the brain, way up in the 90% region instead of the 5 or 10% or whatever the original number is when we're doing a specific task. Now, I find this to be really, really interesting. And I told you on previous shows that my son and I went through some Native survival camps a few years back. And one of the things that they taught you in that experience was that you can literally sense all kinds of things that you normally would have no reason to worry about when you're in the wilderness and when other things are removed, you know, that influence life artificially. These other talents or abilities, or what I call them, they spring back into functionality. At least for a lot of people, they do. Perhaps there are some people that are beyond, you know, resurrecting that function. But I know for me, I was blindfolded in the middle of the night and brought outside of the camp, and we were supposed to just find our way back only by following the sound of a beating drum. And we had a mile to cover. And each person was given a watchdog, as they were called, just to prevent them from walking off a cliff or something like that. But they didn't interfere with what they were doing. They were just to make sure your safety was maintained. And once you got used to it, I mean, it's the strangest thing. You can see. I don't know how to explain it because it's a different type of sight, but you can actually see, and it's kind of like a black and white world, but it's a different kind of vision. I mean, you don't see things like we, you know, like we're used to seeing with our eyes open. But what you see is like, some kind of energy patterns, some kind of incoming flux that can influence your mind. And I would dare to say that if you did this regularly, you could use that facility with a great deal of accuracy. I mean, I only did it that one time, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. But, I mean, for people who might be in the position to do this regularly, I don't see any reason why that facility couldn't be developed to a great degree of keenness. And it begs an explanation in the sense that, well, what is it that you're seeing? You're not really using your eyes. You're using something else. And I think I mentioned in a previous show that I did very well walking all the way back. I had no problem. I could see trees and rocks and all kinds of things around me. And yet I walked out of the woods into the main clearing where the camp was, and I walked right into the side of a parked vehicle. I didn't see it. And later on, I mentioned to the guide that was with me, and I said, well, you know, I find that very strange. I come a whole mile with absolutely no problems whatsoever, and then I walk into the side of his Jeep. And he said, yeah, but that's never been alive.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that was a totally different frequency. And that sight comes about because when you deprive the optic nerve of light, the pineal gland takes over.
Well, it must have some way of sensing things which have natural life force associated with them. And apparently when you process ores into steel and oil into plastic and other chemicals into rubber and assemble it as a car, it doesn't have that type of a signature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Now, if you were able to work with sound, you could perceive objects in that way. And to an extent, as you were walking, you probably used a certain amount of your auditory capabilities. But you see, when you deprive one of the senses or two of the senses, the third sense, which is, let's say, along the lines of kinesiology, feeling, you're going to feel something so intensely that it will actually aid you in producing an image. I could just give you a simple exercise and say, close your eyes and imagine the largest dog that you've ever seen. And describe that dog to me, and you can say, well, I see something. It's very big. It's larger than a Great Dane, and it's black, and it looks fearsome. Then I say, now, listen to that dog bark and describe to me what the sound is. And really listen to what that dog's bark would sound like. And you can hear that in your mind. You can see it in your mind, and you can hear the sound of the bark in your mind. Well, of course, there's no dog there, and there's no sound there, but you can actually tap into some place where that actually exists. And although you say, well, I just imagined that in my mind, in one sense, yes, but in another sense, you've tapped into either a memory or the possibility that such a thing exists, and in some place, it does. And certainly, if it didn't, you could create it just through that process.
Well, I agree with that 100%. As a matter of fact, that, you know, you always introduced me as being an inventor. That very facility is keenly developed in people who invent things, because I always see them in my mind. And then when you understand what they're supposed to be, you go and build it and say, well, doggone, how about that? It was right. It really works. And the interesting thing is, it's not the other way around. Well, you talk to people and they go, oh, yeah, well, you know, if I was inventing something, I could imagine it and work on it that way in my imagination. But actually, it's the other way around. At least it is for me. I'm shown something, and I can see it clear as a bell. And then the logical part of your brain takes over and says, well, okay, that's pretty interesting. How does it work? It isn't that I'm looking at something that I already thought of. I'm thinking about something that I was shown, which is the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's very clear to me, at least, that there's a contact or a connection of some sort to another realm, and there's a portion of the brain that's apparently designed to allow you to look there if you take the trouble to exercise it.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we were to apply this type of thinking, let's say, to a device that lends itself well for producing power or producing work, very, very accurate, very predictable kinds of work, let's say like quartz crystals. And last week you had brought up the topic of the piezoelectricity or piezo devices that are used, let's say, like in clocks or watches or timing circuits. They're actually used in microphones, phonograph pickups, headphones, And even in these ignition devices that you use to ignite gas, say like a charcoal fire. You know the type I'm talking about that has a little trigger, and you can adjust the amount of spark from it, and when you press that trigger, there's an electric charge that ignites the gas. Those are simple uses of that. But it shows that crystal is able to hold a frequency and either, let's say, convert electrical energy in or electrical power into mechanical work, and they work in reverse. You can take a crystal, a quartz crystal. It doesn't have to be very large. It can actually be a small wafer or a tiny sliver tuned to a particular frequency that will allow it to perform a specific function. Now, when you look at the fact that you can do this with these small devices or these very thin devices, it seems that as you increase the size of the crystal and use larger crystals, you can perform many other functions. Certainly, a double terminated quartz crystal, say 3 or 3.5 inches long and about an inch wide, would produce orgone energy or remove door energy from the atmosphere. So we know that from studying Reich's works and the orgone generators and accumulators. What is your hunch on some other applications that we could be using those types of crystals for, or even larger crystals? What could they be multitasking because of their makeup and their shape and their size?
Well, the key word in your delivery there is bigger. I was reading once, as you know, I have a very keen interest in the other explanations for the pyramidal structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget, you know, because I'm not a crystallographer, but I forget what the name of the crystal is. But there is a crystal which is by nature, I think it's a salt, but I wouldn't swear to it. But anyway, it has the very basic pyramidal shape, almost identical to the Great Pyramid. The difference is that it's a complete pyramid in the sense that it's two pyramids base to base. And so the thinking was that if you understood exactly why that thing was built, especially at the size and location where it was placed, that it may be a transducer of other forms of energy that were originally designed to bring that frequency down to a usable level for the purposes of assisting mankind in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, the biggest problem when you look at it from a standpoint of physics is that most people conclude, well, take for example the piezoelectric device that you were talking about earlier. If you just sit a crystal like that on your shelf and you never do anything with it, it'll just continue to sit there. You have to put something into it in order to get something out of it.
Yes.
So if you compress the crystal and distort the lattices, when they pop back, that's when they release that stored energy or that work that was done upon them in the form of an electric current, because you have the various lattices pushed out of shape, and apparently when they jump back, they rearrange electrons and produce a potential. And incidentally, it's a very high potential in a lot of cases. That spark ignition device you talked about can produce a spark at least a half an inch long. And that takes thousands of volts to do that. That's not a small task. But what I'd be much more excited about is not the idea of putting in a certain amount of work and then getting something back out of it. I mean, we already know how to do that in very many facets of physics. What would be exciting would be to have an arrangement that allowed you to put in a minimal amount of effort from a particular source, whether it be sound or electricity or what have you, and for that to undergo an amplification of sorts, which could be powered by either the Earth's electric field or the Earth's gravitational field or the Earth's magnetic field. And then you have an amplifier flowing back and forth.
I described the device to you some time ago that I conceived that could basically transmit light from introducing sound into the crystal, and its purpose would be for health, obviously, but it's using the higher frequencies and the finer energies that we've been discussing in the previous part of the show. That which is there, that science denies is there, yet produces all kinds of unexplainable phenomena because they refuse to recognize that it's at the root cause of these phenomena. So I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to point that out.
It's no problem, but the interesting thing is they talk out of both sides of their mouth because what do you think a laser is doing? I mean, a laser is a crystal. As a matter of fact, the first ones were specially grown ruby crystals that were deliberately impregnated with a certain percentage of impurities, which is called doping, so that they would behave a certain way. And when the crystalline structure is disturbed by light, and of course it bounces back and forth between the two polished ends of the crystal until it just reaches a saturation point, and then a beam emerges, which is usually one very narrow frequency range and contains an enormous amount of power. But even that is pretty much, even though it's an form of amplification, It's the old-fashioned way of thinking about amplification. The operator supplies not only the primary signal, but also the power which is used to amplify that signal. And so even though it's an amplifier, it's not what Tesla would call a magnifier. Because a true magnifier makes use of some form of force or power or condition that's free for the taking and still provides the amplification. So that would be like, you know, you talk into a microphone and put it through a 50-watt amplifier to run a speaker. If you pull the plug out, it doesn't work very well. But if it was receiving power, let's say from the Earth's electric field instead of the plug in the wall, now you have an interesting departure from the norm. And I was starting to say before you interjected your comment that the present day thinking is such that you cannot extract usable work from an intrinsic field. Well, which means that if you have any kind of a field, whether it be an electric field or a magnetic field or a gravitational field, and of course these are stationary, non-changing fields that don't oscillate in time or don't vibrate in time, the current thinking on that subject is that they cannot provide any form of useful work. But Tesla actually demonstrated with the magnifying transmitter that you can use the Earth's electric field for that very purpose if you really understand the wave geometry that you need to produce to interact with that source of power. And then it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time understanding some of that. And the same thing applies to the magnetic field, and the same thing applies to the gravitational field. And it just stands as an ignored area of great potential because nobody bothers to look there. They just say, well, you're taught that it's an impossibility, so why bother with it?
Yeah. If I could interject something here, Jim, and you bring to mind and this would be an example in real life of what you're describing. The average musician has no idea what perfect pitch is or what it means to be able to identify a note and its frequency by name. Say, if you want to say A440, for example, and I use that just for simplicity, the tuning standard. It doesn't matter what the frequency of the note is. I can tell you what note it is using, you know, once we determine what this tuning standard is, I can identify any note. I can hear that note in my head, much like I can hear the dog bark that I described. And anyone can imagine, I truly feel that anyone could actually learn to tune into those frequencies and hear them. Now, I know other musicians or music composers, performers that have perfect pitch that maybe can't describe it the same way, but they do say, I just know. There's a knowing there, okay, which is indicative of a different state of consciousness and the ability to identify something that a scientist would say is not there. So I'm taking Tesla's side and saying that it is there because one doesn't have the ability to perceive it or to measure it or to explain it, doesn't negate it. You know, once you develop perfect pitch and it becomes an awareness, a consciousness, and it doesn't go away. Imagine if we could store and multiply or amplify consciousness. That would be a very useful device that could produce effortless work. If you consider just the 90% of the brain that's not being used, imagine what a human being could do.
Well, I really believe, from my studies of ancient cultures, that, there's a lot of different theories about why there are certain similarities between cultures that are isolated all over the world. And, of course, the one explanation, which is quite controversial but not impossible, is the fact that in time gone by, it was actually commerce and communication and travel between these isolated cultures, and that's how ideas spread around. But there's also the other possibility that using the higher octaves of the brain, they simply plugged in to the general consciousness of the planet or the Akashic record or whatever you choose to call it, and downloaded similar information because they needed the same information. And, you know, that's a fascinating way of looking at things. I think we do have that ability. It's just that in the modern world, it's not made use of except in certain really unusual circumstances or by a very select number of people. But that doesn't mean it isn't part of the gift of being a living and conscious being. It's just not used very regularly.
Well,
but I really believe that it's there.
Yeah, yeah. You described a couple of times on some past shows not too long ago the study that was done with the plants, and a man went into a room and basically hacked this plant to pieces. And another plant, all the plants became distressed, and when this person merely entered a room at another time, the plants there recognized the energy field of this individual and became extremely alarmed and concerned. How would you explain the prayer over the food if there wasn't some energy being transmitted or received on either end, either from the one making the petition or the recipient, the food, of that energy? Pyramids exhibit the same type of phenomenon in terms of preserving organic matter. Same thing. It's the same principle, different application, but it's the same energy being focused at a particular frequency or a particular intensity, amplitude, if you want to call it that, that allows that process to occur. Doesn't need our interference. It does it on its own. Any comment?
Yeah, actually, I do have an interesting comment. One of the reasons why I enjoyed the original Star Wars theory, the Star Wars trilogy so much, was because a lot of the theories that were advanced in the unfolding of that story, showed that whoever wrote it or conceived of it was plugged into these types of thinking. And if you remember the little character that was the teacher of what they call those people. But anyway, the guy's name was Yoda. And when the young kid goes to study under him and asks about, well, what is the Force? And he says that, all living things have an interaction with one another. And the totality of that interaction, is what we call a force, and it can be utilized because it in itself has a consciousness. You know, that is a really, really deep thing. And it's one thing to sit there gawking at a big cinema screen and get entertained by a story like that. And it's another thing to say to yourself, I wonder just how much of that is true and how much of it I can actually access. Mm-hmm. And it's that exact type of thing that that some of the most ancient and most sacred information on the planet was designed to allow you to perfect. And I've always taken great personal offense that the last bastions that we know of where this type of information was held for centuries, places like Tibet, for instance, were desecrated in modern times, for quasi-military political reasons. But I think the real reason is because they don't want that kind of information to be made available to the general public because it's liberating and it is a source in itself of a higher form of spirituality. And yeah. I think those are the real reasons why stuff like that is put down.
Isn't it ironic that information is still accessible, though, regardless of whether or not they hide that history of, let's say, Tibetan monks, for example? I'm presuming you're speaking about the lamas that spent their whole lives studying and perfecting their consciousness under very strenuous circumstances. What the average person would say is through deprivation, where in reality they just simplified the whole process and took a totally natural approach to understanding the subtleties of what you referred to as the force is life force. That's what they were talking about, is life force.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I revert back to this book that I read many years ago, in its unabridged form, which is very, very hard to get now. And it was written by a woman. I can never remember her name, unfortunately, but the book is called Magic and Mystery in Tibet. And it was written by a woman who lived in Tibet for 30 years. And this was like back in the 20s, you know, when it was still a pretty wild area to be in, especially for a woman. And, boy, I'll tell you, the stuff that that lady describes in her writings are, well, let's put it this way, it's beyond science fiction. And yet it was going on a fairly regular basis when she was there, and she learned how to do a lot of it because she really wanted to know. And so, you know, it just goes to show you that it doesn't matter how far out something sounds, that doesn't make it untrue.
That was Alexandra David Neal.
Thank you. You're absolutely correct. That's who it was. And, you know, she spent so many years there, I don't think she ever acquired the level of mastery that, you know, some of those lamas have. But she describes in one of the chapters of her book that she actually undertook to create a being of her own, based on some of the things she had been taught. And she utilized the principles of projecting thought forms and literally created a monk. And she said that the problem was that you have to have such a powerful mind or you will lose control of your own creation. And that's exactly what happened. When this guy got to be solid enough in our plane of existence, he basically just took off on his own and walked out. Now, I have no clue as to what all that means, but I can tell you one thing. Even if half of it is true, it's totally extraordinary. And then she described other things like the art of Lungum Pa, which is a method of walking in a trance that they use, and they follow the ley lines of energy around various parts of the country where they want to travel to, and they can move at an ungodly speed, and yet they're not running. And, you know, they're walking, but they're moving faster than their walk. And she says that, you know, in the mountain passes in the middle of the night, like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you see some monk walking along, and he's doing like 20-30 miles an hour. And he's totally in some other world as far as, you know, trance is concerned. And she describes levitation and levitation of objects. And, oh, and one of the most amazing stories that she relates is the deliberate opening of the third eye.
Yes.
And that's quite an amazing thing. I mean, I know when I was a kid, I really debated about whether I would have the courage to have it done to me or not. I mean, the results are very amazing, but whether or not I would trust somebody to do that to me is another story. But
yeah, you're speaking about soaking, let's say, a wooden wedge in a special solution of herbs and oils, and then driving the wedge into the skull. At the location, that's the technique.
Yeah, they don't drive it in. They actually bore a hole in the forehead, and then they have a way of charring the tip of this thing for hardness and also for the carbon content, and they have to slide it at exactly the right angle so that it doesn't rupture any blood vessels in the brain or anything. And it makes contact with the pituitary. I'm sorry, I always say pituitary.
You meant the pineal gland, yeah.
Yeah, and then they leave it there until it starts to fester a certain way. And then when they remove it, they unscrew it a little bit every day. And that leaves a permanent channel between the outside world and the pineal body, which supposedly heightens your all of your psychic abilities if it doesn't kill you. But it's an amazing story. And it really makes you wonder, why would anybody bother writing about something like that if they didn't actually see it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not something you think about some afternoon, you know. Oh, I think I'll take a special shard of bamboo and soak it in this or that, and then I'll bore a hole in my head and see if I can get it down in there just right. It's not exactly in the normal line of thought.
Yeah. Well, a monk who went by the pen name of T. Lobsang Rampa, and eventually when the communists invaded Tibet, as was predicted by the monks hundreds of years prior to that event, when he went to Canada, he had written quite a bit about all of his experiences. And they, as a young man, or really as a boy, they opened his third eye using that method, and he was quite phenomenal as to the things that he accomplished. I don't know if you're familiar with those works, but very compelling writing and very deep, honest discussion about what it was like to live in a saffron robe and have to climb up and down the mountain just to get water.
I'm familiar with his writings. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite ones is called The Cave of the Ancients.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the fact that there are actually caves in various places of the world. He said he saw one in Tibet that contains various types of technologies that are left over from places like Atlantis and Lemuria, and they're stored away only to be brought forth when the world is again ready for such knowledge. And I found that a really interesting presentation. It was pretty amazing. As a matter of fact, it affected me a lot. I was all set to go over there and look for the darn place. But, he was a very interesting guy. He obviously knew a great deal about spiritual matters and the laws that pertain to that, which is not common knowledge to the everyday person.
Yeah, he primarily dealt with, I think, you know, the struggles of the physical body and the mind, of course, and then his experiences as his spiritual gifts blossomed, we'll say. He was inspirational to a lot of people, and certainly his own people recognized this gift that he had, and that he would play a major role in their survival, despite, you know, this communist invasion, which resulted in the murder of thousands and thousands of these monks, because they wanted to destroy this knowledge and preserve it for themselves, you know, come up with some militaristic way of using it.
Well, thank God that's a very difficult thing to do, because the very fact that your intent is in that direction oftentimes prevents you from even understanding the forces that you're trying to capitalize upon.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that respect, I think a lot of the hermetic knowledge will always be safe. But
yeah,
the people who possess it will not be safe, because you have these greedy morons that will resort to any kind of torture or any other method that they can think of to try and have you divulge these secrets for their benefit. And the irony of it is, even if you did, they wouldn't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Now, if we come back full circle into, let's say, looking at types of technologies, are you at liberty to share any interesting projects that any of your friends or associates may be working on or have worked on in the past that are sort of biding their time to spring forth into the everyday consciousness of people around the world?
Well, on the medical front, I know of a person who is working and has been working for at least 20 years on a Tesla kind of a device, which allows the use of electricity for the purpose of reestablishing the basic resonance that exists in the body to the hydrogen signature in the universe. And the interesting thing about hydrogen is that it's the first element, and so it has a very fundamental frequency upon which all other frequencies are actually constructed. And Hess's theory was that if you have an illness, let's say like cancer, for instance, it means that your parts of your body have somehow departed from the sympathetic resonance that they have with the fundamental frequency of the universe. And if you can reimpose that same frequency on the human structure at a much, much higher level of intensity than the subtle hydrogen signature, then you will force the body to get back into sync with the primary frequency or the fundamental frequency, at which point you will lose the disease. And it's taken him years to develop this. The interesting thing is, to date, he's cured a lot of people of an enormous number of diseases and other problems. And I have a very strong belief that there's something fundamentally true about what he's doing, because it's repetitive. You know, mm-hmm. It isn't a question of it only works now and again. It doesn't work all the time. You know, you can't go in there on your deathbed and expect the thing to be reversed. But if you expose yourself to this condition and you do it religiously for a period of months, I mean, he's cured all kinds of stuff. And
now, would this be something that Randy developed? I won't give away his whole name, but
no, this isn't anything to do with Randy. Although Randy has his own method that works in a very similar way, except it doesn't require a technology. And I have a lot of respect for what he's doing, because even though I don't 100% understand it, it's one of those things where you want to understand it until you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, once you get the gist of it, then it's a question of how powerful you want to become. But he explained to me on a number of occasions that the way that his healing process works is it's based on this this very subject that you yourself brought up in tonight's show, the idea of knowing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of you that knows already. And he said, you know, you can use this for anything. But when it was a more pronounced gift and utilized on a regular basis, it was a gift that everybody was aware of. And then, you know, when we became sort of civilized, so to speak, and I don't think much of civilization in general, we lost this gift because it atrophied.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what he's saying is that it's like, did you ever meet somebody and you never saw them before in your life, but you just know that you don't like this person. There's something about this person that is not good for you on some level. And
I sort of felt that way during the last presidential campaign. So I know exactly what you mean.
Oh, my God. Well, anyway, it's exactly that type of knowing that he's describing.
Yes.
And it can be utilized, for a lot of different things. And so one of the ways that he makes use of it is that he has figured out a way to calibrate it. And I don't know exactly how it works, but it's something to the effect that, like, for instance, let's say, getting back to kinesiology, you have a bottle of vitamin pills. And, a lot of people have the ability that you pick the thing up and you see if you feel weaker or stronger. And if you feel weaker, then it's no good for you. And if you feel stronger, then it's something that you should probably use. Well, that's only step number one. And what Randy managed to do was that he actually managed to say, okay, how much better is it than not using it? You know, and so what he came up with was a secondary use of the same facility that's associated with a counting procedure. So what he does in his mind, he'll just say, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how good is this? And you've already identified the fact that your body can make use of it. Now the second thing is, how good is it? So then he'll just say, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how good is it? And then he'll start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, whatever. And when he feels that same knowing at a given number, he stops counting. So let's say that he gets up to a 6 or a 7, then you have a pretty good idea if 10 is, you know, absolutely perfect for you, and it rings out at a 6 or a 7, then, you know, you have a good idea where it stands with respect to what your original intention was, which is to use it for nourishing or assisting the body. And that's an amazing thing to be able to do that. He was teaching a class a number of years ago. I don't know if he's still doing that, but he was teaching a class that actually laid down the fundamentals of showing you exactly how to make use of that. And it was I attended the class. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I found it pretty interesting that a lot of the people that were in there were catching on to it. How far they could go with it, I don't know, but they at least were catching on to it.
Well, that confirms what you said and in a sense what I said, that this is available to everything in the universe to tap into. And you know, we've been sold this bill of goods that things that that produce power or work are of a particular makeup, and only those things are to be used. Well, when this energy is flowing through you and it becomes part of your awareness, part of your consciousness, you don't consider where it's coming from. I mean, you give credit and there's an understanding, but you don't consider it in a way to judge it, to say it's natural or it's unnatural or it's allowed or it's forbidden. That's insane. You know?
Well, to consider the source.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in that same sense, you know, if we're looking at ways of running equipment that we have, if it means a way of coming up with a technology that takes the free energy is what is there. It's free. It's there. It's always been free. All we have to do is capture it and store it and then transmute it, which you've already said.
Well, you know, getting back to that subject of the visualization and the experience that I had in the Indian camp, you know, where with the blindfold and everything, I had a guy that I went to school with in high school up in Rhode Island. I won't mention his name because he holds a really, really prominent position right now, but he was an amazing mathematician. His abilities in mathematics were almost hard to believe. And he shared something with me once, which I thought was really, really profound. We were working on some logarithms for a project in nuclear physics, and it had something to do with particle accelerators. I don't remember anymore what it was, but I said we were sitting on adjoining desks, writing down these various relationships, and I said to him, "Well, that looks realistic." I said, "Let me get my log tables, and let's solve that problem." He goes, "We don't need the log tables." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, just a minute." And so he just sat there quietly for a second, and he started writing numbers down. So I said, his name was John. I said, "John, where the heck are you getting this from?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you a little secret." He said, "You've worked with a slide rule before, haven't you?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." And he said, "Well, you know that you can solve logarithms on a slide rule, right?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, all I do is picture the slide rule in my head, and I use it in my mind, and I get the right answers." And that just blew me completely away because, you know, it sort of insinuates that he has to picture in his mind all of the characteristics of a slide rule and all of the calibrations and all the numbers on it. And, of course, if you can see it, you can use it. You know, and I had never thought of that, but this guy had a memory that was bordering on a photographic memory, and so if he could literally picture a slide rule in his head, he could use the slide rule that he was picturing. And that's an amazing thing. I mean, you know, it's, where are you when you're doing that?
Yeah, that's, well, you know, they teach sales techniques to people for compartmentalizing lots of data that are to be stored and retrieved later on in a conversation with a customer. It could be electronic specifications, or it could be names of songs, or it could be features that an appliance has. It doesn't matter. You can compartmentalize the mind and store that information in a specific place. As long as you simplify where you store it, it's as easy as visualizing a file cabinet and going to the letter of the alphabet that particular word would be stored in. It's one way to do it, and I understand that. In another sense, I understand more etherically what he's doing, because it's like what I was describing with music and perfect pitch. Hearing the whole orchestra play the piece before the music is even written down and played.
Yeah. So that's exactly the kind of gift that some of the world's greatest composers have. I mean, they compose that stuff in their head, for God's sake.
Yes. That's where it occurs with me. Doesn't mean I'm one of the greatest composers.
We have such amazing powers and such amazing gifts that if you really itemize them and consider them, then it makes perfect sense that we are made in God's image. I don't mean physically, but I mean as beings that can create and beings
yes.
that have the ability to make use of spiritual forces. And I think that that's where we really need to be focusing, is right there. There's no physical similarity between us and God. But the interesting thing is, if you have beings on another world that look entirely different from us, I mean, they could look like porpoises or octopuses or giant sea slugs, but if they're conscious as we, or perhaps more conscious than us, then they too are made in the image of God, and it doesn't have anything to do with their shape. You know, we have this really weird attitude that there's something special about human beings. Well, there is, but it has nothing to do with the way we're shaped. It's because we have these gifts, and we're not really making use of them.
Yeah, well, see, you just made a statement that's asserting a truth that's intentionally hidden from mankind, somehow as if they tell us on the TV news that there are no other planets and there are no other intelligent species anywhere in the universe. Oh, my God. God really screwed up on this experiment, didn't he?
Yeah,
and his greatest achievement would be the television and the newscaster delivering that message. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, does that mean that he works for the propaganda department?
Well, you know, whatever floats your boat, I guess. This is why we are in the state we're in. Ultimately, it's this repressive indoctrination into a system that's totally built on insanity and lies. And certainly, a crystal can teach itself what it needs to know to produce all kinds of different functions. And you mentioned water too. I think water is life. It sustains life in every aspect of its existence. And I think it's misused and abused in many ways. It's given to us in a cocktail of poisons. They call it tap water. And it's certainly being abused in the Gulf of Mexico right now. I mean, there's karma for all this. There's got to be cause and effect. And I think we've yet to really experience all the effects of all this insanity that's going on. It's time that people wake up and start using their higher gifts and realizing that these things are right here now. They're in front of us now. It's not something that we have to lift a rock to find. It's right in front of us.
And it's always been there, too. That's the other
Yes. thing. Yes. Well, Jim, we're out of time. As usual, it's been interesting. I could go on for many more hours on this topic, but we'll have to save it for another show. So I want to thank you for being on the show. Any closing comment you would like to make before we say goodnight?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had one. I seem to have lost it somewhere along the line. I think that a good closing comment, though, would be that if you're a Bible enthusiast and you're familiar with Genesis and we know about the fall of man, it's perfectly okay to believe that the fall of man has to do with the original sin. But I personally think that the fall of man is the loss of the gifts we're talking about tonight.
Makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's only a personal theory, and I could be wrong, but that's what I believe.
Well, those are sacred gifts, too, intended to help guide us and empower us through this experience called life. And I agree with you in that respect.
Well,
I do.
The interesting thing about it is, though, that, you know, we have the personal choice of either developing these facilities or rejecting them. And so, in a certain sense, the fall of man is determined by man himself.
Yeah, that's by definition what a free will universe is about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for another enlightening show, and Look forward to seeing you on Evident Footprints next Friday.
I should be here, God willing.
All right. All right. You have a good weekend. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and tonight's special guest, Jim Murray. Also, if you're interested in having a device developed, say a prototype, Jim and his partner George have a service through Accurate Machine and Tool. You go to my website, directlightproductions.com, click on sponsors. They're right there on the index page. Click on the name, Accurate Machine and Tool, and you will be amazed at the quality of service and information and help, assistance that's available to you. Of course, if you don't check it out and contact them, I can guarantee you, your invention won't work. Not until you get it into production. So that's something that they'll sit down and talk to you about and see if they can't help you. So I thought I'd remind the folks, Jim, again, have a great weekend, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you, Doug.
And we'd like to thank those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, also blogtalkradio.com. Special thanks to Seth Hendrick on the sound at bbsradio.com. Also want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next week, next Monday, when my special guest will be Dr. H. Huat. In the meantime, I wish you a great weekend, and I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.